the edge of our hope, at the end of our time. We have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show.
Cordelia helps Errol get ahead in Barry Iron politics.
I'm Trisha Yim.
I'm Kate Trott.
I'm Paul Weimer.
And I'm Stina Light.
And today on Reading Rangers, we're discussing Barry Iron by Lois McMaster Bujold.
Huzzah!
Huzzah, indeed. This is the second book in the internal chronology of the Vorkosik verse. So I'll just give a plot summary of what happens. Cordelia Naismith, now Lady Vorkosigan, finds her atavistic dream of settling down on Barriar to raise children with Lord Errol interrupted, first by politics, as her husband has become the Imperial Regent, then by a semi-abortive assassination attempt, and then by a coup. On the way, she renews relationships with Lieutenant Kudelka and Sergeant, now Armsman, Bothari, and picks up some allies, including Alice Vorpatril, Princess Kareen, and Ludmila Drushnikovi. She helps bring the young heir Gregor to safety during the coup, and then takes direct action to rescue her son, who is named after her father Miles, because Errol's father, Count Vorkosigan, refuses to recognize what he calls a mutant as his heir. Ku and Drew fall in love despite his nerve damage and his stupidity about women. Princess Kareen dies trying to kill Lord Vordarion, the coup head, and Cordelia has Bothari finish the job. Having impressed all the Barriaran males with her prowess, Cordelia makes Errol promise to make the world a better place for everybody's children. In the epilogue, 5-year-old Miles wins over his grandfather, Count Piotr, through his willfulness, fast talk, and love of horses.
Good summary.
Good summary.
Quite thorough.
Thank you.
So the one thing that we have to get into right away, though, is why Piotr needed to be won over and what's going on with poor little Miles, right?
Yes.
Sure.
If you like, sure.
So you want to start with that?
Sure. So because the assassination attempt is in the form of a gas, and it's a particular gas that there is an antidote for, but the antidote causes bone density problems, and those are correctable in adult humans, but they're not so good for fetuses. And so there's going to have to be a lot of medical intervention to bring Cordelia and Errol's baby to term, and he's probably not going to be normal even after all of the medical intervention takes place. Fortunately, at least, they're able to deliver him C-section and put him in the uterine replicator, which that's got to be the most goddamn beautiful feminist technology anyone's ever thought of in science fiction. You can tell a woman wrote this book because, oh my God, I wish those were a thing.
I don't know. I just read an article about motherhood mortality rates, and it's actually directly linked to C-sections, the number of C-sections that are happening. The United States actually leads the industrial world in high mortality rates.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of it is connected to the fact that women more often than not are given C-sections, whether or not they need one.
I'm not thinking about it that way so much. I would assume along with this technology would be a safe way to remove the child much earlier.
Well, here's the deal. What happens is, subsequently, everything goes well in the first birth on the C-section. It's the subsequent births where the placenta starts growing out of control as a result. And they don't know, they're not aware of this happening until after the birth has happened and the woman is bleeding to death. I like the idea of a unit where the mother can go about doing what she needs to do and all of the life-endangering stuff happens in a machine rather than... So I think it's a wonderful idea, but I don't know how practical it honestly is. You know what I mean?
Well, we can just hope that medical technology will get that much better in a few centuries. Maybe not even that long.
There's a Connie Willis science fiction short story called Even the Queen, which is about birth control technology and improving it and how it is a driver for women's health and women's liberation, basically. And once it's adopted, social changes sweep across the earth and they can't imagine life without it. So I was really thinking that as we've been reading these first two novels and seeing how the uterine replicators are important. And as I recall, they will fade mostly into the background and not really become a big deal again until later in the series. But that's way down the road.
But so anyway, Miles is going to be like a dwarf and possibly otherwise deformed is what I gathered.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And this country is really big on the patriarchy, especially among the Vor, especially for a count's heir, which is why Count Pyotr wants Lord Vorkosigan and Lady Vorkosigan to abort this child and just start over with better luck.
except the same antidote also seems to threaten Errol's ability to maybe produce more babies. So that whole scenario was so dramatic and well presented, and my heart was in my mouth through the whole thing. That was one of the highlights of this book for me, was just how strong Cordelia had to be and basically taking on the entire culture to give her baby a chance. That just, I loved that.
Yeah, that was really cool. Maybe it's because I've read ahead, I got the impression that the decision to not have other children was actually a conscious one, not one that was a medical issue. But I guess I didn't pick up on that when I read Barriar.
In this book, it's medical. I mean, later on, they decide not to, because to have other children would probably require a visit by the both of them to a higher tech world, like, say, Beta Colony, and they're having enough problems with importing technologies to Barriar as it is. That might be a non-starter to have, have an important Vor to try to have medical technology to have children again. Are they really his children? Is this legal? And that's before you get to whole Jackson's Hole and other things. And of course, way down the line, when we start really seeing how this medical technology hits this culture hard, it does rock the boat. So she's playing her cards close to the vest for now, because I believe that she was seeding things that prop up 12 books later. But we'll get to that in due time. I don't want to give any spoils, but yeah, this is not the last time we've heard about heirs and genetics and other things on Barriar, much less the rest of the galaxy.
That's one thing that I really, really love about this whole series, is that she doesn't just play with an idea for a minute and then put it down and go away. She keeps following consequences and ramifications. And I just love how things come back and hit you again 4 books, 6 books later there's this thing too.
I think you hit the mark. Some readers will get that pun. Others will have to wait a while.
So I was getting the impression that with this being written, you know, the publication order and the internal chronology being so radically different, that we are running into a Richard Sharp kind of problem with prequels that were maybe more advanced than the original books. Is that the case here?
A little bit, but probably we should go back, since I failed to do this after the introductions, and just give our overall impression of the books, just to try and be consistent within our Reading Rangers series, just to, instead of instantly just diving down a bunch of rabbit holes. Okay, so first impressions, Kate?
Okay. I liked this one even more than I liked Shards of Honor. Like I've already said, I really got into the whole scenario where Cordelia is having to defend her unborn child, not just from local threats, but from the entire culture into which he's going to be born. That combined with her wilderness weeks where she's keeping the heir to the imperial throne safe and all of her travels on horseback. I mean, she really has gone back in time as far as comparing her life on Beta to her life on Barriar. Barriar?
I've always said Barriar. I don't know what the audiobooks do.
The audiobooks pronounce it Barriar.
Then I shall do so forthwith. Barriar. anyway, I found this a wonderfully feminist book, but it didn't give the male characters any short shrift. I thought Bathari's character development was exceptional. I really liked the story of Drew and Ku. There's nothing about this that I didn't just love. So there.
Paul.
I found this an interesting rereading experience. When I first read Barriar back in the 1990s, I had read them in basically publication order. So I read Swords of Honor, The Warrior's Apprentice, Ethan of Athos, Brothers in Arms, The Boar Game, and then this, which is set before Brothers in Arms or The Boar Games or The Warrior's Apprentice. So it was, at that time, it was like, oh, prequel. Okay. I know Miles has to live. How is he going to get born, basically, was the way I had come across it back then. Because by that time, I had had three books and change of Miles, so I had already keyed onto Miles rather than Cordelia as a character anymore. This time, however, since we're reading in a internal chronological order, I can see this as an extension of the themes in Shards of Honor. We have the Uterine Replicators again. We have Cordelia trying to find her place now within Barriar and society and culture as Lady Vorkazigan. We see all the intense world building of let's see what Barriar really looks like from the ground up by sending her out into the wilderness, which again is an echo of her wilderness travel in Shards of Honor, except this time we have an inhabited mountainous landscape for her to basically get lost in. So I kept finding all these resonances with the first novel, which delighted me because I didn't catch them the last time because I had been several books removed from them when I had come across this novel.
They were both very consistent with each other, these first two books.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it kind of blows me away that they were written so far apart in time.
She definitely kept her information control on a pretty even keel between Shards of Honor and this one and the other Miles books that are yet to come. There aren't any gaping, like, well, wait a minute, you said in this previous book it's like this, now it's like this. I mean, the fertility problem, as I said, is explained by them just like probably just not choosing to, but other than that, there's no weird inconsistency, and it doesn't really feel like this is a more advanced than the earlier novels, so there isn't that sort of anachronisms that show up here. It feels like an older end of the old empire culture that's slowly evolving under Gregor's rule in the next novel. So I think she hit the balance pretty well.
Yeah, I think she did a very good job. I didn't even realize it had been that long between the first one and this one. So I hadn't even understood that. One of the things that I really, really liked about this is how she conveys the idea of how the society itself is changing so rapidly, you know, and you can see it in the person of Miles's grandfather, or, you know, because he's going through like all of these changes. And at a certain point, he's just stopping. And I just felt like that was so pertinent to what's going on politically in the United States right now. There are so many people that everything is changing so rapidly that there's a certain sector of people who just can't handle the progress anymore.
Stop the world, I want to get off.
Yeah, that seems to be what's going on. So I really liked that, seeing that in an imaginary world. You don't see that very often, frankly. And particularly in a world that reads, even though this is science fiction, Barriar itself reads kind of like a fantasy world, because you've got people with horses and like the cavalry and like all of that stuff. It's really hard I don't know. It's really great seeing that element of society and change going on. And the politics. I have a thing about politics. I love politics. In fantasy and science fiction, it's one of my favorite things, because really, if you get three human beings together, you're going to end up with politics. So I just think it's fascinating, the whole thing. I like the way the politics are handled. I like the way the relationships are handled. And I like how she talks about disability for the most part. Not that being an abled person, for the most part, I don't really get a vote on that one, but I think she does a good job overall on everything. So I really enjoyed it.
Great. Thanks, Dina. As for me, like Paul, this is the second read of this book after having read the whole series, most of the books multiple times. I think all of them, but certainly most of them. So for me, rereading this book was all about resonances that I saw with the other books. So I don't want to talk about that just yet, in case we get to, you know, those specific moments later. But I did want to say, let's see, I just adored the scene where Cordelia was hearing about the caravanserai, the very poor quarters of the capital city. She's hearing about that for the first time, and she's unable to process the thought of people not having comm consoles or, you know, personal computer terminals. You know, she can barely imagine that standard of poverty, let alone not having access to healthcare and education. And that's her fate and privilege, where she really can't understand the lives of the people that her husband is ruling, or a large number of the population. And that is one part of Baton civilization that I wholeheartedly support. The book makes it pretty clear that that's the way it ought to be. But of course, Bariar has come through incredibly difficult times, so they probably couldn't have lifted everyone out of poverty even if they had wanted to, but they're not actually trying because of the whole Vor privilege system, at least not at this point in time. And that's one other way in which things under Aeryl as regent, he tries to push things in that direction. But I think you get a little of that in this book, but it's also a thing that will happen later, and with Gregor too. I hope that's not too spoilery to say.
No, I don't think we're spoiling our readers too much, or our fellow podcasters here who haven't been through the entire series. And
it's pretty well foreshadowed.
And at the very end, Cordelia is astonished that the old men in the Council of Counts say that she is to have no power in the raising of Gregor, and yet they turn control of his education over to her. So
they don't realize the implications of what they're doing.
It just shows how clueless they are about what women are capable of doing, and what really happens in those crucial early years of a kid's education. Because, you know, a lot of cultures have been like, well, you're with your mom until you're, you know, 10 years old or whatever, and then you're with the men. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if mom's your only influence before then, you know, that's when you really learn to relate to other human beings. When you learn things like empathy and sharing, all of those unmanly traits.
Right. Now, of course, there have been a fair number of cultures where all that stuff does get beaten out of you if you get, you know, turned over to the soldier culture.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm reading a book about Afghanistan right now, and everything is very, very much gender divided along gender lines. And that seems to be less of a mitigating circumstance than you're leading people to believe, I think.
And I have to agree there too, Stina. I started studying the Arabic language and discovering that there's a whole different conjugation of verbs depending on whether the doer is male or female kind of blows me away.
Yeah, I really find it fascinating how much world building actually is, how much of a culture is actually installed in a language, you know, and how much you can actually get out of about a culture just by understanding the language and little things like that. I find that absolutely fascinating.
It's a side note, but have you read Jack Vance's The Languages of Pal yet, Stina?
No.
You should, because it's about a culture that gets attacked basically by attacking and changing its language. What language as a basically cultural meme / weapon?
Languages of what?
The Languages of Pal, PAO, by Jack Vance.
Got it. Thank you. I'll look it up. Yeah, it's very, I think it's just extremely fascinating, the language aspects of things. Anyway, sorry. I feel like I took everybody off track.
No, it's just a side note.
Well, it's a side note, but I think when you're talking about a book that's as culturally rich as this, as the world building in this book is, it's really, if you just talk about the plot of the book, you lose a lot. So I think it's perfectly legitimate to go off on some digressions in this discussion. But we should probably go on. Does anyone want to talk about themes in the book? Of course, we already talked about cultural change and motherhood. But does anyone else have any particular things that they want to bring up like that?
I want to talk about the mountains. Because, you know, I love world building. So we have Cordelia in escorting Gregor, basically dumped in these mountains, and we get a long sequence of her living the hill country life and trying to hide from the usurper's forces. And it's really interesting terrain because Lois McCastabuzo lives here in Minneapolis. There's nothing like those mountains anywhere around here. So I'm thinking, how did she so visualize these so perfectly? This feels like kind of like Appalachia as far as endless valleys, lots of tangled ways, isolated communities, very conservative, closed-mouthed people, but who, if they welcome you in, will support and protect you. And I just found the whole mechanics of, and she gets it right. You can't travel 200 miles in a day on a horse. I was so glad you read so many science fiction fantasy novels where they go on horses forever. And there's never any consequences. Here, horses get lame and they have to give up horses because they just can't go anymore. It's like, yay!
Horses are not motorcycles.
Thank you, Tina. Yes, horses are not motorcycles. And while she does have her air car is another thing, and the one case the air car breaks down, the horses are not motorcycles and she knows it. And it's important to the plot that they're not motorcycles. And also the fact that trying to search out people in hill country is difficult and not impossible if you just keep throwing people at it, but not difficult.
So, I love the whole cave gambit too.
Yes. Let's get the soldiers lost in the caves.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. I've been in cave systems like that where a whole army can end up getting lost, running into each other and thinking they found something. And in fact, ha ha ha, your quarry never went beyond the first room. They just made you think so. So it's that I totally bought that because some of these big caves, oh yeah, I could totally see an army just blundering around in there for a month. It was funny, but it was also awesome. It was really resourceful, and it was also a little bit of a relief because I saw right away that that would work and that Cordelia and Gregor were going to get away.
Yeah,
because sometimes the tension in this really got to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was really cool. I mean, I spent a good part of my childhood in Missouri, and we visited Merrimack Caverns quite a bit, which is the cave that is written about by Mark Twain. And so the whole idea of the army and getting lost inside the caves and such is just absolutely fit.
Yeah, one great part of that whole thing is that it reminds us all that Cordelia is a scientist, and she's had some experience with field work. And in a lot of, you know, the rest of the book and in a lot of the later books, it's much easier to just see her as a Baton sophisticate who, you know, is still navigating the culture of Bariar. But it's really great to see her using her experience and knowledge to solve her way out of a problem with her brain, not with Bothora using a blade.
Can I tell you guys a funny secret? A podcast
sure.
secret.
It's just
everyone's
us.
Everyone's going to hear soon. It's just us, yeah. I've moved beyond the Cardassian and Bajoran thing, don't worry. But now in my head, Cordelia basically looks like Alex. Our own dear Alex. Alex maybe wouldn't be as interested in putting on a dress as Cordelia is, but so there you go, Alex, you're my Cordelia.
Well, Cordelia is made of awesome, and so is Alex, so it fits for me.
Yep, but totally, especially when it got to the cave stuff, I'm like, oh, basically, yeah, our favorite geologist. That's the sort of thing that they would do.
There is a point in Beriar in biology that I wish she had hit harder. She briefly mentions it in various books, but in reality, Beriar flora is poisonous to Terran animals, and
that makes sense.
So Beriar's really has been terraformed. It's not something she thinks about in this book. I mean, she thinks about it way down the line with Sergiar in a much later book. I wish she had thought about it here now, but I guess I can't have everything that. Well, so how are the native plants dealing with the invasion of Terran plants? Because it's been some centuries, but it takes a while for an ecology to push the other out, even if one has a better adaptative advantage. So we never get scenes of her trying to stop horses from eating a local bush because they'll kill it, for example. that would have been nice to have that, if I have to criticize it. But because there has to be some local flora around. It could have been all wiped out.
Certainly not in the mountains.
Especially not in the mountains, and especially when they had lost technology for centuries.
Yeah, but then what would she be feeding the horses? I mean, as she's riding away and like trying to hide, wouldn't that be a dead giveaway? I need Terran food for my horse.
Well, they do have hay and other provender. They do mention that.
Okay.
Well, because there's basically a Pony Express up in the mountains. I mean, that's right. Who she's traveling with, the Imperial Post Office. He uses horses, so.
Although the word express is a bit much for what he's doing.
Yeah, a pony mail system. Yeah, but you can't just turn off a horse and let it chomp the local grass. It would have been nicer to emphasize that point a little more, but I guess you can only squeeze so much world building into a book before it starts bursting at the seam. And we get here Beriar and politics and cave systems and just the bones of the mountains. To invoke Alex again, as far as, you know, the lay of the valleys and how it's like, oh, we're higher up than we used to be, and it's lovely country that's really nicely invoked. I mean, I can see why the Volkazigans like to have their house right where they're, and there's even that ruin of the castle up on the thing to indicate the earlier society. It's nicely layered that way.
Yes. I like that it just, the whole Beriar does not give the impression that it woke up, it suddenly appeared yesterday. I like that a lot.
Something else that I really liked was that we don't just have one mad scientist working on Miles, but two. Captain, and then Dr. Henri. And the difference it makes when one of them is no longer in the picture. I thought that was really deftly handled, and I thought it was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And I liked that they both wound up. You don't see Henri as much on screen, as it were, as you do the captain, but still enough to really get a feel for what it's like for them. You know, you get the idea that science is pretty hidebound still on Beriar, but they're confronting the difference that the replicator makes, and that there's this one guy who's willing to take on the challenge of making sure Miles grows a skeleton. Mm-hmm. But it's probably the only guy in the whole planet, and it's this army captain. I love that. I love that whole thing too. And I really like the way we never were allowed to just forget that situation when everything else was going on. It would be really easy to just sweep that under the rug until we got back around to, oh no, what about Miles? But no, Bujold kept it always part of the tension of the story. While Cordelia's having her adventures with Gregor and everything, there's still this, what's going on back at the lab? How are they doing back at the lab? What's it like back at the lab?
Yeah, because being his mother, she would be very concerned. It would be a concern that traveled with her wherever she went. So I like that too.
It was a tightening screw until she couldn't take it anymore. She had to go rescue Miles. Consequences be damned.
Yeah, that was very, very well done. Just the building of tension at several points in the book, and the, you know, sudden, sometimes violent releases of tensions, I thought were very well done too. And just so the pacing throughout the book, I thought was really interesting, the way that it rose and fall, and sometimes it gave you time to stop and think about what was happening, and sometimes you were having to think about things while things were happening, boom, boom, boom. And I really liked the dynamics of the book in that respect. One other thing I wanted to talk about was the rise of women in this book, not just the woman of Cordelia, as you had in the first book, just her and a bunch of men and Dr. Mehta at the end, or close to the end. And of course, several of the books after this. In order of publication before this, there had been a string of books that were mostly about men and the military, with a few female characters in there. But here in this book, we have inklings of how, in addition to all the military stuff that goes on, there's a whole bunch of women networking things going on, trying to affect society in their way, with the men being largely oblivious to it. And I really, you know, it's something that appears again later, but I really love how it's developed here. At first, Cordelia is basically alone in the Vorkosigan men's household, and then she meets Princess Corrine, the mother of the heir, and Princess Corrine sees how isolated Cordelia is. Cordelia does say something about it, but Princess Corrine realizes how that is for her, and so she sends her female bodyguard away, and that's Drushnikovi, to give Cordelia a little bit of help and support in her own household. And also Cordelia meets Alice Vorpatril, her husband's cousin's wife. And Alice, of course, is very important in this book and to the series as it goes on. So I just love how all of that is, you are brought to a sense of the importance of women in the culture, in addition to the men running the military.
Have any of you seen The White Queen?
Oh, yes.
Nope.
Trish?
I have not.
Oh, okay. So The White Queen was a series, 10 episodes, I believe, from England, about the Wars of the Roses from basically a female perspective.
Hmm. Okay.
I believe the tagline was "Men fight, women wage war." So it's basically it focuses a lot on Queen Elizabeth and the other members of the court for and against her, as basically Richard II and Richard III and Edward and all scheming for the Wars of the Roses. It basically focuses mainly on their relationships and their attempts to secure legacies and power, mainly through building alliances, children, and whatnot. So that. Since I've seen that since reading this, since first reading this book and now reading this book again, I've realized that that sort of model of female power and female dynamics is something that more media in our society are trying to come to terms with. Beria does a better job. I mean, I think if she had written the book today, it would probably focus even more on that. And this book was written sixth in the series, and we'd had after Shards of Honor, a lot of. And we will, since it'll be in internal chronology order, a lot of, as you said, Trish, a lot of male-dominated books coming up. But this one, she tries to break out and have more, women are important and here's why. Women are the glue of society. And there's even a line about how women keep the bloodlines. And we mentioned before how control the education. And I don't want to say this novel is a feminist empowerment book. I'm not sure I have the right to say that or I can articulate that, but this novel does bring women front and forward in a way I didn't quite get at the time when I first read it back in the 90s. I was young and stupid. but I see it now.
Well, and I like that a lot of the power that these women demonstrate and exercise is not in the men's sphere. I mean, I was especially taken. I would have loved to have seen more of Princess Corrine.
Mm.
Pity.
Yeah, she was really a neat character, and we only got a couple of scenes with her.
But what we got from her was this immediate demonstration of incredible emotional intelligence. You know, she's got one, she meets Cordelia, and not only is she sending Drew to support Cordelia, but she saw in Cordelia a provider of something that she couldn't for Drew, which is a sphere in which Drew could actually exercise her talents and develop her strength in a way that being the princess's bodyguard really wasn't going to. But just she grasped that so quickly just from talking to Cordelia for a few minutes. She's like, oh, that's where Ludmilla belongs. And that's where Ludmilla is going to come into it. And then having the guts, because I really got the impression that Drew was maybe Corrine's only friend in the palace, or at least the only one she really, really trusted. So that she gave that up was really amazing.
Right.
It was a stunning concession to give her to Cordelia, giving up your major lifeline that.
Well, I don't see it as a concession. I just saw it as like, this is the way it's got to be. And maybe not grasping exactly how important that decision was going to be for her son's future. But, I mean, just look at the outcome.
Right. But, you know, Drushnikovy was probably the one that she was kind of huddled with when she was wondering whether Azar would lose control and Pavel would be in control of her and hurting her and her son, probably. And, you know, so Drushnikovy would have been one who went through the tough times, the really tough times with her. And then to give up maybe not her strongest ally, but her closest ally like that, that was a real sacrifice on her part.
Mm-hmm. But she saw that someone else was going to need her more, I think.
Right.
It's like, okay, I'm done with my security blanket. There's someone who needs one now. And the fact is that it'll also give my security blanket a chance to be a person.
Right. But it was also a play for long term because she knew that Drushnikovy would come back to Gregor eventually, or back to his orbit anyway.
Yep. But really, that was probably, now that I'm looking at the whole book, that's probably the single most important decision in the whole book. Because so much of what happened afterwards would not have been possible.
Right. Without the inside knowledge that Drushnikovy had of the palace, they wouldn't have been able to pull off the rescue attempt, and which evolved into actually the act that won the war.
And so I wasn't at all surprised toward the end when Corrine was just like, you know what? You know what? Screw all of this. I'm going to kill him. I'm going to do it. Me!
Well, who knows what he had put her through. We know she wasn't willingly becoming his lover, but, you know, who knows how much of that she hid.
Cordelia.
Right.
Yeah, Cordelia, had the emotional intelligence to realize that, no, she's not doing this willingly.
She read the body language from the stupid surveillance video.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, that woman is a hostage.
Right.
Not a collaborator at all. Wow. So I'm a little disappointed to hear that we're not going to have as much of this stuff in the upcoming books, I have to admit.
Yeah, the next couple of books are going to be all mostly space opera.
Well, I like space opera too, but I like space opera with girls.
Sadly, tragically, Miles is not a girl.
Well, but he seems like he's going to be quite a character, so I'm content for
definitely.
Now.
Yep.
Yeah, that we can definitely say.
He's definitely Cordelia's kid. Mm-hmm. 5 years old and already ruling the room just because he's like, if I'm cute and enthusiastic, no one's going to care that I'm only 2 feet tall.
Right, which isn't really Cordelia's way of handling things, but he does get her keen insight into other people from her and from Ariel.
Yeah, I mean, Ariel still seems kind of like a cipher to me. But, you know, with so many books where like the female character is just sort of sketched in and the males, it's all that I'm fine with it. I didn't mind that he seemed still a little two dimensional to me. It just feels like balance in the Force.
There is some further on at retcon describing of Errol and his life, especially in the in this last book, Gentleman Joel and the Red Queen. And in that book, well, we mentioned it before the podcast, we probably should talk about in an artful, in an artful turn of phrase that Bujold uses in this phrase and in this book, where Cordelia says that Errol was bisexual.
Right. She says, if Vordarian is trying to, as she realizes later, he's trying to sabotage their marriage. And so Vordarian tells Cordelia that her husband is bisexual. And she corrects him and says, was bisexual, now he's married. And I certainly winced on rereading that.
I'm guessing you did, especially because you've read Gentleman Joel and the Red Queen.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I first read the book in whenever it came out, 98 or whenever it came out. Or maybe, no, it can't have been.
91,
right. So I was not really as aware of things back then.
Neither was I.
And so that didn't bother me then. Reading it last Sunday, it bothered me a lot. But to her credit, I believe that Lois McMaster Bujold's viewpoints on that evolved also, given what happened in a later book, or later books.
Yeah, I agree entirely. It sits as an artifact of us starting at the beginning of her canon, and the author herself has changed since then. And society has changed. I mean, back then, that sort of phrase for 99% of society would have not taken note of it. The 1% being people, LGBTQ people probably at the time. Right. Was like, wait, what? But that was a not well-heard voice in those times. Nowadays, if someone wrote this novel like that and had that line like that, there would be people very upset and very vocally so, and not just LGBTQ people, and rightly so.
Absolutely. Yes. But I mean, I think it's important to allow an authors are human beings just like anyone else, and everyone evolves over time, and I think that's important to keep that in mind when reading someone's works.
Well, and it's not necessarily the author's perspective on bisexuality that's...
It could be just the characters.
Yeah. All we know is the character says that. And the character has grown up in her own set of circumstances and her own world that has its own sometimes bewildering ideas about people. You know, the whole gaslighting thing when she came back from her expedition. Mm-hmm. So it's quite possible that her society is not as advanced in recognizing that bisexuality is a lifelong real thing, just like having blonde hair or whatever. and it's quite possible that Bar Yar, in that one sense, is more advanced. We don't know. But it's just like I got a kick out of I'm behind on Doctor Who, but so I just saw the Eaters of Light episode. And there was a moment where Bill is thinking that this Roman is hitting on her. And she's like,
oh,
no,
yes.
I like women. He's like, well, I do too. But, you know, and finally he's just like, well, if you want to be so restricted, that's your choice. And I respect it kind of thing. It's like he's the one who's just like, oh, you're kind of narrow-minded. I didn't realize. So that little reversal, I really got a kick out of that. But, yeah, there's been plenty of military cultures where bisexuality was just not even whatever. So why not Bar Yar? And why assume just because they have uterine replicators that Beta has a more enlightened attitude toward that? Maybe Beta doesn't. Or maybe Cordelia's just a reactionary in that respect. But I don't think it's got anything to do with Bujold necessarily. We can't say that Bujold thinks this just because that one line of dialogue's in a novel.
Fair enough. I had a different question about Cordelia's personality and stuff. I wonder if any of you picked this up as well. It felt like there was almost like a tension to this novel, because every so often she thinks home is where her people are. She says that explicitly, but then on a couple occasions, especially when the chips are down, she says, "I want to go home," and it sounds like home she meaning Beta Colony. Did that, any of you read that, or am I mishearing that in the course of the novel, that sort of tension between her two different conceptions of home?
Yeah, no, I read that too. I got that too.
I think her mind wasn't as made up that Bariar was home as she was telling herself it was. I think her instincts were still with Beta.
Yeah. Having gone through a period of time where I abandoned my entire life and moved to a different city, I could very much relate to what she was going through in that regard, because there's always going to be a part of you for quite a while who's going to think of the previous life and how much different things are and what you've lost and missing the security involved with familiarity. I really related to that. I thought it was really cleverly done, frankly.
The impression that I got just from the glimpse we got of her family life in Shards of Honor was that home has always been kind of a slippery concept for her, and that because her family life didn't seem to be that great. And she just really, really just seemed to be all about that period right after she and Errol got married, when they were living by the lake and just, you know, living very briefly the very privileged, happy, relatively carefree life of the Bariar upper class without any responsibilities, until boom, the regent thing happened. But that's what I thought she was mostly wanting when she said she wanted to go home. I never even thought about Beta, because Beta just looked like, you know, a trash heap for her.
Well, I mean, it's possible that, speaking as someone who doesn't have like the best relationship with family a lot of times, it's a complicated thing. It's not cut and dry. You can cut off your entire family and still have feelings where you miss them and miss certain aspects of them. It's not on and off switch. It's very complicated, very, very complicated. And I really, frankly, enjoyed that part of it, that she wasn't 100%. Well, that life's gone and over with. I've abandoned that, so I won't even think about it anymore. But she at least admits that, you know, even though her previous life may not have been comfortable for her all the time, she may not have enjoyed it all the time, it may not have been even supportive of her all the time, she still misses the security of familiarity. And I can't stress that enough. That's a huge thing in human beings, is the security of the familiar. The unknown is terrifying, you know? It's just how we are wired. And to bravely drop everything and go into the unknown like that it's terrifying. It's really, really freaking scary. And I love that she didn't, I love that she bravely did it, but then I also love that she suffered consequences in many ways for it. I mean, she got advantages, mind you, and I think she made the right decision, but, you know, that's how I feel about it.
I do think that by the end of Bariar, she's become, how can I put this? She's as good as playing the Bariar in games in some ways as they are, because they respect her for having gone and taken care of the would-be pretender. And she's scared. She's kind of like, what you're complimenting me for that? But it's kind of like the, you know, like she's like the fish out of the water dropped in a new pond and quickly learns to be better at that than some of her counterparts. And given this sense of this place of responsibility and power, though they don't think she has it, that is going to have enormous consequences for their society, because she's molding the future emperor. And we don't really see that on screen so much, because the next book in chronological order is going to be The Warrior's Apprentice.
Chronology.
Chronology.
Yes.
Right. So we start with Miles in military school. So we jump the 12 years or so. So after this epilogue. So we don't see how she influenced Gregor, but except through how Gregor acts and what he does and how he starts guiding society, we get to see indirectly her influence that way. I don't think we really see her really influencing things directly like this again. Help me out, Trish.
Brothers in Arms, really, I think we feel her strongest influence next.
Yeah. Yeah, and then it starts dropping off as Miles takes more and more of our headspace. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, but it'll be interesting to see what you first readers have thought, although some of you have read ahead, I believe. Right, Stina?
Yes.
So it'll be interesting to see how those of our listeners who are reading along with us will feel as we continue to go through the internal chronology and seeing how Barry Aron's society, from this little seed of letting Cordelia have this position of influence, changes an entire world.
Hmm. Yeah, I want to talk about just a couple of points of resonance that really struck me when I was doing my reread. The first was how the whole turmoil and agony and uncertainty that you see in the ultimately unsuccessful coup attempt in Bariar, that really gives credibility and weight to how in a later book in the series, someone tries to kill Gregor and dozens of people fling themselves into the pathway that he'd have to take to protect him, because nobody wants to go through that again. And I appreciate that greater weight. It seems less like, oh, military chivalry or whatever, and really the whole, no, we're not going through that again. That's worth dying for, to stop that from happening again. So I liked that. And also, there's a point in this book where Lord Vorkosigan believes that he has to execute Karl Vorhalis, the nephew of his late friend, Rolf, for dueling. And that leads directly to Karl's brother, Avon, doing the Saltoxin assassination attempt that affects Miles. And then I was thinking, in the Mountains of Mourning, Miles is overseeing a capital case. He's been sort of lent the regent's voice. And so he's overseeing a capital case, and he has to decide a similar situation. And you see in this whole story how Cordelia's efforts to make a better place for their children does indeed help civilize Bariar. But the decision that Miles makes could only have been thought of by a native Bariaran. So I just thought that was really fascinating.
I hadn't thought of At the Mountains of Mourning, but now that you got me thinking about it, yeah, it's set in the backcountry. Miles is acting with the authority of
the Emperor, basically.
The Emperor and House Vorkosigan, because I believe it's in the Dendari Mountains, and he's got that thorny problem to deal with. And not to mention, he himself is their own prejudice against quote unquote muties. So yeah, that's interesting. I like that, Trish.
Does anyone else have any particular moments or insights that they want to share?
Well, I got to say my bit about Kareen, so.
I don't have any other ones.
Okay, so thanks, Paul, Kate, Stina. Thanks to our listeners for joining us today for Reading Rangers. And next time, I guess we'll be tackling The Warrior's Apprentice, right?
Yep.
Okay. Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Happy reading.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter @skiffyandfanty, on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanti Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/skiffyandfanti. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Chronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.